KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, the U.S. Supreme Court will be ruling soon on public school integration, and we'll brief you in the hour ahead all about what's at stake and how the two sides stack up on the issue. Can school systems use race to promote racial integration and diversity and make it a determinant factor for public school enrollment? Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. It has been over half a century since the United States Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus the Board of Education that put an end to segregated schools. The High Court now is poised to decide on two school assignment plans in Louisville and Seattle to voluntarily maintain racial integration. And in this opening hour of forum, we want to look at the case about to be decided by the Supreme Court and discuss its significance. Joining us for the hour, first we want to welcome from up in Seattle, Alice Mundy, who's a journalist with the Seattle Times. And this case involves not only Seattle, but Louisville, but also involves San Francisco and many other districts as well. But the specific specific case revolves around Seattle and Louisville. Welcome, Alicia Mundy.
It's Alicia, and just so your readers, your listeners know, I'm actually based in D.C.
Okay, sorry, you are indeed, and thank you for that. We also are going to be talking with Sharon L. Brown, who is principal attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and here in studio, Gordon Liu joins us. He's assistant professor of law and co-directs the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Race, Ethnicity, and Diversity at UC Berkeley School of Law. Welcome, Goodwin Liu.
Thank you.
Alicia Mundy, let me begin with you, just so we can give listeners a kind of broad picture here. This case could affect really hundreds of school districts that are grappling with how to achieve diversity. What is at stake here in terms of just what those schools are doing and what they need to do?
Well, these are really two. This case involves two school districts that were combined for this one case, Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle schools. In theory, it's about one case. In theory, it's about one case where two separate school districts attempted to achieve something close to a racial balance or a racial pattern that mimicked the local population pattern, using what they hoped were narrow means that would pass muster with the Supreme Court. But in practice, I guess the background noise to this is that there's a lot of concern that this is probably going to be one of the last big cases to possibly undo all the efforts at legal integration. Certainly the New York Times and any number of other legal journals, other newspapers, have referred to this set of two cases, Louisville and Seattle, as Brown versus the Board of Education Round 2, or the end of Brown. There are many school districts across the country. We couldn't even count them anymore, but we thought there were at least at one point 15 that we had tried to track that have adopted somewhat similar plans, very narrowly construed plans, to try and achieve more of a racial balance in their schools that matches the racial population. And so they're all watching this very carefully.
And what happens to those schools if indeed the court rules, as some are speculating, because of Alito and the way the court is divided now? Of course, it's always difficult to predict, but what happens if indeed the ruling goes against Louisville and Seattle?
All of those school districts are probably going to have to look very carefully at their own situations and figure out how their own plans are proceeding and whether their plans are too close to the Seattle and Louisville ones. They may have to undo them. It's a very odd situation. I think most of the school districts that have what they think are narrowly construed plans to try and promote racial integration in the schools, I think most of those basically thought they could breathe easier a couple of years ago before Sandra Day O'Connor left the bench, December of 2005. The bench Supreme Court declined to hear a similar case based in Lynn, Massachusetts. They had allowed the integration plan to stand there, and people breathed a sigh of relief that that meant the upcoming court was not going to be hearing some of these other cases like Seattle and Louisville. But that changed a year ago last June when the new court with John Roberts and Sam Alito decided they would hear an integration case very similar to one they had decided not to hear. And so, you know, we're all holding our breath.
Alicia Mundy with us from Washington as a journalist with the Seattle Times. Can you give us sort of the picture of Ballard High School, which is really in your backyard, and what happened in Seattle?
Well, there were two high schools, Ballard and Franklin High School. In Seattle, that were part of an attempt by the Seattle school districts to take the 10 high schools they had and see if they could get them integrated so that they would reflect the school population. The school population in Seattle is 60% students of color, 40% white. Seattle and in Seattle, Franklin High School and Ballard High School were practically equidistant from a small white housing area called Magnolia. And at one point or another, the parents in Magnolia in the early 1990s, when Seattle was trying out other plans, including busing, mandatory busing, the parents at Magnolia in this sort of upper middle class, mostly white area, had wanted to send their kids to Franklin. It was a better school. It had better scores. They pretty much insisted that was really their neighborhood school. But during the mid to late 90s, the situation at Ballard improved considerably. The test scores began to rise. Principals were moved around. They got some creative programs going. And it was during that time that the superintendent there, Joseph Olchevsky, working with the school board, decided to implement this school choice plan, whereby you chose the high school you wanted your children to go to, and if they had a school that had more applications than they had places, there would be a racial tiebreaker. By this point, the Ballard High School had become much improved, and parents in the largely white upper-class section of Magnolia and thereabouts wanted to send their kids to Ballard. At one point or another, the people who chose Ballard, sort of the mid to, let's say, 97 or rather 1990-2000, there were probably only 75 applicants to Ballard, specific applicants who wanted that school, according to our former superintendent. By 2000-2001, you had nearly 500. The school had improved so radically, and they had too many applicants for too few spaces.
Alicia Mundy, again, is a journalist with the Seattle Times. She's with us from the nation's capital, and we're discussing the implications of a pending Supreme Court ruling on the use of race as a factor in school integration. Goodwin Liu is assistant professor of law and co-directs the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Race, Ethnicity, and Diversity at UC Berkeley School of Law. And Professor Liu, I imagine a lot of your concern with this is that if the lower court decisions are overturned by the Supreme Court, it could lead to mass resegregation?
Well, I think that's right, Michael, and resegregation is already happening throughout the country. Let me say a couple words of broader backdrop to the description that Ms. Mundy gave. For over 100 years, the nation has prized its public schools as places where people of a variety of different backgrounds, ethnicities, races, religions can get together to learn and to build together a democratic society. The Supreme Court of the United States has recognized this this idea repeatedly throughout its history. In 1948, it described the public schools as the most powerful agency for promoting cohesion among a heterogeneous democratic people. And of course, in Brown, the court said that education is a principal instrument in awakening the child to cultural values and also the foundation of good citizenship. And of course, this all these statements have been more in the nature of ideal than reality, because we've had a history of some troubled history in our public schools.
De facto segregation.
De jure segregation,
and
going
jure,
all the way back to the time before Brown. But here, at the dawn of the 21st century, we have a handful of school districts, Seattle, Louisville, and you mentioned San Francisco, also Berkeley, where I live, that have, as a matter of their own democratic decision-making and educational judgment, decided to try to pursue a small measure of racial integration in their public schools. This is not court-ordered busing. This is not being compelled by any sort of legal order. This is a matter of educational policy judgment that the school districts themselves have sought to exercise. And so what they've done is they've combined elements of school choice as well as sibling preferences as well as neighborhood boundaries, all sorts of factors, with race being one of several, in order to achieve public schools that look something like, and it's not inflexibly parallel, it's just an approximate range, looks something like the surrounding community, so that the kids who go to these schools will grow up to learn and live together and learn to work and play together in a fashion that will resemble their democratic life together as citizens.
The ideal being diversity and some measure of heterogeneity and experience from different groups and ethnicities and so forth. And I think that ideal has been linked to better academic performance or better overall education by many, although that continues to be controversial. Although I think maybe the greatest controversy might stem from the fact that many see this as social engineering by school bureaucrats, and race being a factor that's as volatile as it is, some would say, well, of course, we'll hear from Sharon Brown on this, I'm sure, but that race shouldn't be part of that equation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you hear that term social engineering, but what is schooling? But a form of values transmission. We have public schools in part, not just because we want every child to succeed to his or her own individual potential and achieve all the sort of private benefits of schooling that schooling can provide, but we also do it because we're trying to transmit certain cultural norms and cultural values. And one of the most important cultural norms that we have in our democratic society is the ideas of tolerance, mutual respect, and harmony among our citizenry that are so essential, especially as our country becomes increasingly diverse.
Again, we're talking with Goodwin Liu, who's assistant professor of law and co-directs the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Race, Ethnicity, and Diversity at UC Berkeley School of Law. Sharon Brown is the principal attorney of the Pacific Legal Foundation. The Pacific Legal Foundation has been involved in this case, in both cases, haven't you, Ms. Brown?
Yes, we were involved in both cases. In the Seattle School District case, we were involved filing amicus briefs all the way up through the United States Supreme Court. And in Meredith, I had the privilege of sitting second chair at the United States Supreme Court in support of Crystal Meredith, the parent in those cases. What I'd like to do is just clarify some background here and make sure that everybody understands that these voluntary choice programs that are in place in both Seattle as well as Louisville impact all parents, not just white parents. In Seattle, close to 300 students were denied admission to the high school of their choice simply because of their skin color. Almost 100 of those students happen to be black students. In Louisville, Kentucky, the school district denied a transfer application for a 5-year-old who wanted to attend an elementary school closer to his home. The school district had placed him in a school that was 90 minutes away. When there was a school closer to home, there were seats available, but simply because he was the wrong color of skin, he was denied the admission. So it's very important to understand that these types of programs impact not only white parents and white children, but minority students as well.
But I think your position is even more profound than that, because you believe that any kind of race-based policies that are about diversity are, well, illegal and racial discrimination, ultimately.
Well, yes, they are illegal. When we take a look at the Equal Protection Clause, which is what the provision under the Constitution that was used to challenge these programs, it says that race should not be used as a factor, and it should not be used as a factor in assigning students to public education.
But if racial diversity is the goal in education, and many seem to be in agreement that it is, you have justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Souter saying, well, if that's the goal, then it's acceptable. Why isn't it acceptable to use racial means as an end to that goal?
Because it violates the Equal Protection Clause. Government should not be looking at
students or anyone on the basis of their skin color. It does not. There's also social science evidence that is going both ways. There are no educational benefits that clearly would allow the school districts to use race as a classification to correct social choices of parents and where they want to live. The social science research that these school districts are relying on, it's not uniform, it's value-laden, and it's not only that, it's litigation-driven.
You don't accept, for example, that managed choice can help academic performance of minority kids?
No, there's no uniform body of social science research that can support that. At most, it might be a minimal improvement, but it certainly does not justify using race to assign students to public schools. And what Professor Liu was saying is that we use school districts to impose cultural norms for good citizenship, but what are we teaching our kids? We are teaching our kids that race matters more than their individual merit. And the other thing is that there are race-neutral mechanisms that are out there that school districts can use to promote integration. One is whether or not they should provide preferences on the basis of economic means. Poverty is an area that really needs to be addressed. And if the school districts use poverty to limit the number of students who can attend any particular schools, then we're reducing the impact of these racial isolated schools. We're opening it up to others. Wade County in North Carolina has an excellent program that they're using where they limit the number of low-income students in any particular school. Not only is it achieving breaking up the poverty, but it's also doing integration, providing parents with more choices. If integration is such an important social norm, then you would think that the parents would voluntarily choose the school that they want to do. But the school districts in Seattle were completely different. They had different, the schools had different qualities to them.
Sharon Brown, let me go back to Professor Liu just to get his response to your bringing up the Equal Protection Clause, because that's certainly a central legal argument here. Goodwin Liu.
Yeah, I want to say a word about that, because that is the provision of the Constitution on which this all hinges. I think it has become a somewhat unmoored from history to read the Equal Protection Clause as prohibiting programs of this type. The Equal Protection Clause was adopted in the wake of the Civil War as a measure to guarantee a degree of equality to disenfranchised and enslaved blacks who had been subordinated under a caste system and then continued to be subordinated under a caste system of Jim Crow. And Brown versus Board of Education, in reading the Equal Protection Clause to prohibit segregated schools, basically said that we cannot have a caste system in America, and that the Equal Protection Clause is directed at this kind of subordination of one group to another through official policy. Now, I think it would be a very strained reading of the Equal Protection Clause to say that here you have a situation in which kids are being assigned to different schools, and every kid gets a space in some school, and to some degree, the quality of the schools is determined by the student composition of these schools. To now say that people who are denied a place in the school of their choosing have in some sense been subordinated as a member of a racial group, similar to the way that the plaintiffs in Brown versus Board of Education were subordinated on the basis of their race in 1954. I just don't think that historical comparison could be made with a straight face.
Let me ask Ms. Brown, is that the historical comparison that you're vying for here?
No, actually, when you take a look at, there are two Brown versus Board of Education. The first one talks about that separate does not equal the educational opportunities that all students deserve, which is just a terrific ruling. The second decision in Brown 2 says that school the ultimate goal is to make sure that the public school systems do not use race in assigning students to public education. So that is why the reporters and the legal scholars are mentioning that these two cases are the next chapter in Brown versus Board of Education. The other problem that we have is that these types of schools where the students want to attend are based upon the quality of the education that is being provided by those schools. And it seems very strange that we are going to limit some students to be receiving these types of educational opportunities, but denying the same opportunities to other students simply because of their race. What we really need to have the school districts focus on is to make sure that all the students receive educational opportunities and not limit it to, like in Seattle, the top five schools. Why aren't they paying attention to the bottom five schools and making sure that those schools and those students attending those schools are receiving a quality education?
Let me bring Alicia Mundy back into this.
Yes, I'd like to clarify something for your listeners. Ms. Brown had talked about the Seattle schools and what had been going on. I just want to restate that the plan, the open choice plan, as they called it, only applied to high schools. It had nothing to do with the elementary schools. It had 10 high schools. And Ms. Brown mentioned that there were 300 students one year who were denied their school of choice. It's important to note that 90% of the parents who chose their schools did get the schools they wanted at the time. Since Seattle, in light of this lawsuit being pending, since Seattle stopped using the racial tiebreaker in 2001, its white schools have become less diverse. They've gotten whiter. The schools with more immigrants, minorities, have gotten a higher immigrant and minority population. So they are, you know, falling back into the other patterns. And the issue of racial diversity and why you can't call it that, in fact, was raised during the arguments on December 4th. Sharon was arguing, and I was covering, and both Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and David Souter both asked why, if everyone agrees that having racial diversity is an acceptable goal, you can't use any kind of racial standard to get there. And Souter kept saying, why do they have to hide the ball? In other words, why is it that you can go and try and get racial diversity, but you can't actually say you want racial diversity? And I really do think they focused that morning, at least the four justices who have hung together, they focused on why there seems to be such a discrepancy here on whether or not you can use racial diversity whether you can use parts of racial diversity as a means to an end if you accept that it is an appropriate end.
I'm coming up on a break, so I'm going to have to interfere here for a moment. Forgive me, but I need to also give out the phone number because I know listeners will want to join us in conversation here discussing the implication of pending Supreme Court ruling on the use of race as a factor in school integration. Of course, those of you who have been following this case know that there are lots of things involved in this with the whole question of affirmative action and the University of Michigan case and Hernandez versus Texas. But at this point, I'd like to invite those of you who are listening to join us if you have questions or comments. You can do that by dialing in toll-free from wherever you're listening or however, on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and you're listening to Forum, and I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're focusing this hour on the implications of the pending Supreme Court ruling on the use of race as a factor in school integration, decision which is expected to be handed down fairly soon. Sometimes we look at the Supreme Court decisions before. There was, of course, a big decision that was decided upon just the other day, and sometimes we do afterward. But this is certainly something that will affect schools here in Northern California and throughout the state, and is being watched very carefully by parents as well as public school officials, administrators, and teachers. We're talking with Alicia Mundy, who is a journalist with the Seattle Times, who's with us from Washington, D.C., and Goodwin Liu, who's here in studio, is assistant professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law, and he co-directs the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Race, Ethnicity, and Diversity. And Sharon L. Brown, who is principal attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, who's with us by phone from the state capitol. I'm going to go right to your phone calls, and let's begin with Gianna. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
You're on the air, Gianna. Welcome.
Thank you. I am a public elementary school teacher here in San Francisco, and I just wanted to call in and add a little bit of an insider's perspective. That I know that San Francisco is one of the districts that does use some, you know, race as one of many factors, and we have a very complicated placement system that no one's happy with. But the fact that race is used somewhat to try to have diversity in our schools, I, as a teacher, still see that the schools are incredibly segregated. And, you know, I think that anybody who thinks that race should be ignored should spend some time in a public school that is majorly, you know, is the majority African-American or whatever the disenfranchised group is of that city, and witness it. And, you know, those students deserve more. They deserve a diverse environment to receive their education.
Let me thank you for your comments. And I want to get a response from Sharon Brown on this. Here's a school that's supposedly trying to make things work, and yet here's a teacher who says incredibly segregated, to use her phrase. Sharon Brown?
Well, race cannot be used as a factor in assigning students to our elementary and secondary schools. What both Seattle and Louisville are doing is racially balancing their student bodies. They're using race mechanically to make sure that there is a certain preferred mix of students in each of the schools. And the United States Supreme Court has always said that using racial balancing to achieve a specific percentage of students is unconstitutional per se. If we look at the University of Michigan law school cases in which race was used as a factor in...
My comment was about to say, not to get into the legalese of it, but what I'm trying to say is that I think that any effort to have diversity in our schools is very well... it should be well received. It is well worth it, and the minor efforts that are done currently are not even close to enough.
But what you're doing when you are using race is you are violating the Constitution, especially when there are some race-neutral mechanisms that are available to school districts that would not violate the students.
Let me go to that, if I may, with Goodwin Liu, because you've mentioned it for the second time, Sharon Brown, and you're talking about economic means, for example, as a measure. And
yeah,
I wonder what you say on that, Goodwin Liu.
First of all, let me say that I think Ms. Brown misstates the case law. I think that the Supreme Court could well agree with her, but it would be a departure from the precedents that it has issued in the past, in which even in 1971, in the wake of Brown and its implementation, a unanimous Supreme Court with 5 Democratic and 4 Republican appointees basically said that school districts can, as a matter of their own educational judgment, go about prescribing a fixed ratio of white to black children. That was the case at issue there in its schools. Courts won't do that, but school districts, as a matter of their own discretion, can do that. Now, with respect to race-neutral measures, the San Francisco case is actually very instructive. Here you have a school system that was under essentially a court order, a consent decree from 1983 to about 2001, during which time, in the early part of that consent decree, race was used as a criterion for achieving a degree of integration in the public schools, and it worked. In 1997, at the apex of the integration effort, you had a multiracial city in which virtually all of the public schools had no majority racial group in it, which is fitting for a multiracial city like San Francisco. After the consent decree was challenged in a similar type of lawsuit as the ones we have here, race was removed as a factor so that now in San Francisco, race is not considered in the assignment of kids to schools. And instead, the district opted for this thing called a diversity index, which took into account a variety of socioeconomic factors, including parental education, income, a whole bunch of things. It's very difficult to understand the index, but nonetheless...
Are you suggesting because race was taken out, maybe the caller is seeing much more of a segregated situation?
She most certainly is, because... as a result of race being taken out in the last 5 or 6 years, San Francisco has dramatically resegregated such that now over one-third of the public schools have greater than 60% single-race enrollment in a multiracial district.
I want to get more callers on. And from Sacramento, Al, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I am afraid, and I'm wondering what the speakers might think of this, is of the fact that in the college admissions cases, you know, there was such a compelling reason for, you know, for having diversity. And you had, you know, organizations like the U.S. Army or the Armed Forces, you know, by Friends of the Court briefings along with Corporate America. And I doubt that that same of sort of support has come out in the school district cases, because my question, I guess, is that the court lately has been really taking, like, into account public opinion, like in the separation of church and state and all of those things. So do any of the speakers fear that the court may be more willing to go with parental control, you know, of their own school districts instead of trying to impose, you know, erase, you know, fix?
Well, again, it's hard to predict, but Alicia Mundy, you've been court-watching, and this is a more conservative court, clearly.
Well, I think right now the betting, at least on the Seattle-Louisville combination of cases, I think the betting is that it's going to come down 5-4 against the school districts and against their racial diversity plans. You could see at the morning of the arguments back in early December, Justice Kennedy, you know, is considered the swing vote, and he was first out of the box just charging, and he was very, very harsh on the lawyer representing the Seattle School District. Of course, he wasn't particularly soft on the attorney representing the parents either. But if he's the swing vote by the end of the morning, you could pretty much say that Kennedy seemed very, very skeptical of plans for racial diversity. So that appears to be where this one's headed, and the betting is that it's going to come down 5-4.
Let me thank Al for his call. I want to go to more of your calls. And Carrie, joining us from Hayward. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you again for a great program.
Thank you.
I have a quick question. It has to do with multi-ethnicity. We have a lot of parents and a lot of children that share different ethnicities. And also, how taking children and taking them into different schools to mix up ethnicities also affects the way that grants are given to schools. For instance, like in California, we have the ACEs grant, which is based on how many children are enrolled within a particular school that qualify for the free lunch program. There's a $130,000 grant at the elementary level available, but if you change the ethnic makeup of that school, like what's happened at my children's school, they did not qualify for that grant.
Let me go again to Alicia Mundy on this. Things seem to often divide in people's minds between black and white, but this is a multi-ethnic question, is it not? And what about grant money?
You know, grant money, I have to tell you, is not something we have looked at. Certainly I've looked at closely because I was looking at the legal end of it and how it was being fought. In Seattle, we have a program which also is coming under attack at the same time that it's actually being adopted in other school systems around the country. It's called the Weighted Student Formula. And it's a form of a grant. It's that the student basically, based on their income, gets the money, which then becomes portable. It's part of a fund, and it's portable with the student, so that if many students choose to go to a certain school, and they've got this portable fund that then goes to that school, that school then has an increase in resources that it can use, and it's an easy way to also pinpoint what schools have problems. But you're right, the portability then becomes an issue in terms of federal funding and grants. I mean, it's very difficult. The multiracialism, the multiracial mix of the community is something that Seattle schools juggled with when they were trying to come up with the open choice program, because you would have people who had adopted Asian children. You also have just a huge mix of interracial marriages in Seattle. And depending on where you wanted to stand at any one moment, using diversity as a standard could work as easily for you as against you.
Again, Alicia Mundy is a journalist with the Seattle Times. You, if you would like to, can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. And Tom, you're on.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in San Jose, California. I want to point out how the term diversity has really become degraded here, and it's a symbol of our confusion about race today. I would point out that unlike 1955, we are not two societies, one white, one black anymore. We are really now a multiplicity of races. And in fact, the very best schools in the state of California, Cupertino's Faria, Santa Clara's Millikan, are extremely diverse, but they happen to be diverse in a way that nobody has even touched on here in this conversation. They have very high concentrations of immigrants from East Asia and South Asia. So it would really be helpful, I think, if we could try to look at this clearly through the actual state of race in America today, which is much more complex than black and non-black or black, white, and Mexican. And I think it would also be helpful if we could get back to the to keeping our eye on the ball here. I would take issue with what the law professor characterized as the mission of the schools. He said it was values transmission, if I got that phrase right. I would submit that, again, looking at the example of Faria and Cupertino and Millikan and Santa Clara, the school's primary purpose is to inculcate basic skills and to give the students a rigorous, well-grounded academic education. Let the parents take care of the imparting of values or transmission of values, if you like.
Let me get a response from Goodwin Liu on that.
Well, I think that you know, the caller, I appreciate the sentiment behind the caller's point about complexifying, if you will, the discussion of race in America. Let me just say a word about the mission of the public schools. You know, it reflects a big debate, I think, that historically we've had in America about what the ultimate purpose of public schooling ought to be. And it seems to me that one of the primary reasons that we have public schools, meaning why is it a state-provided function, provided in a communal form and made, in some sense, compulsory for virtually all students who can't buy themselves into a private school, is because we have some important set of societal goals that we're trying to achieve, not just to enable every individual child to reap the private benefits of education, which surely they ought to, but in addition to help reproduce a society in the mold of our greatest aspirations. That has always been the ideal behind the public school, the common school, and that is very much at the heart of what these school integration policies are all about. I will say that the previous caller, maybe one or two callers back, was talking about whether or not there is a social consensus behind these policies that is comparable to the social consensus that was behind the affirmative action policies considered 4 years ago in the University of Michigan affirmative action cases. There have been a lot of friend of the court briefs filed on behalf of the school districts in this case. In fact, I, together with my colleague and dean, Christopher Edley, at Bull Hall, filed an amicus brief on behalf of 19 former chancellors of the University of California system, basically saying that if we're going to have a successful multiracial society, one that is democratic, inclusive, tolerant, and fair, we need to begin at the very beginning of where we build that society, which is with children in our public schools. And if we don't model in some way in our public schools what we hope our ultimate society will be like, then we're going to have a lot of problems in the years ahead.
Let me go back to the legal issue here. And Sharon Brown, I'd like you to respond to, if you would, a listener named Dave who says, could we get your anti-guest to clarify whether she is saying that the government has no right to legislate anything that would affect the degree of diversity and thus the performance of schools? If so, that seems ridiculous to me to contend that our Constitution would not allow the people to petition for legislation that betters the opportunities of citizens. It's ludicrous to say our Constitution would handcuff that effort.
Well, the Equal Protection Clause purpose is to ensure that people are treated as individuals rather than based on the color of their skin. And so if we're starting to teach our students at the very early years that their race means more to how they're going to be treated than their individual merits and their self-worth, then what we're doing is teaching them that race matters. The whole purpose of the Equal Protection Clause is to make sure that race is not part of the factor. And when we're looking at social science, and including when we're looking at the University of Michigan law school case, the only reason that race could be used was as one of many, many factors, and it was only limited at that time to law schools, because law schools' whole purpose are to teach people to how to debate different perspectives and different viewpoints. And when you have students that are admitted with race as one of many factors, what you're doing is you're bringing in different backgrounds and different experiences together. That does not translate into our public school system when you're dealing with a kindergartner or with a high school student. There is no consideration of the individual students. They're using race mechanically, and they're only using the color of skin to assign the students to the public schools. And that's going to be one of the biggest stumbling blocks that these school districts have in overcoming even Justice Roberts' statement that we have to look at children as individuals and not as members of a racial group.
Sharon Brown again is principal attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation. One more email here. Alicia Mundy, I'd like your thoughts on a listener named Sally saying one of the guests just mentioned that in Seattle the white schools were getting whiter and that the schools with immigrants were seeing greater numbers of immigrants. As race becomes more and more a point of difference and pride, I wonder how much of that, if there is school choice, is self-selecting. Has that been looked at, or are people just hyperventilating about lack of diversity?
Well, what happens is that this, without any kind of incentive for basically proactive diversity, you have the schools reflecting the housing in Seattle and their enclaves. So you have the white upper class. You have the areas in the southern area of the Seattle boundaries that have a preponderance of immigrants and also preponderance of lower income kids, and the northern area is whiter and is more affluent. If everybody sticks with the schools that are closest to them, then what you have is the breaking up again of white versus people of color. And it's very odd in Seattle again, because the school system by and large is 60% students of color and 40% white. So you end up with these little enclaves that aren't mixing and mingling, so to speak.
Speaking of percentages, here's Mike who writes, the only thing San Francisco achieved with their school lottery system is that 30% of the kids go to private school. Three times higher than everywhere else, and the schools in the Bayview are still bad. Let me get another Mike on here with us from Rohnert Park. Hi, Mike, you're on.
Hi. I was just wondering if any thought had been given to the fact that quite a few people who are of any number of races will voluntarily segregate themselves just because they want to maintain friendships with people who they share a culture. And I'll take my answer up here.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Good one.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and in some ways, the sentiment there, and I'm not describing the sentiment to the caller, but the idea that people of a particular race may want to simply associate together was one of the arguments raised way back at the time of Brown versus Board of Education. When Brown was decided in 1954, there was a very influential law review article written some years thereafter that basically took a skeptical view of Brown versus Board of Education by saying, well, who is government, meaning the Supreme Court of the United States, to say that people who want to, through democratic means, choose to associate only with members of their own race can't do that. And who is to say that the Constitution imposes this sort of value-laden idea that segregation is unlawful? And yet we have come over the past 50 years to accept that basic moral proposition that segregation is unlawful, not simply because it doesn't reflect a neutral principle of free association. It reflects the subordination of one racial group to another. And here, I'll reiterate my point, there is no way in which the school district policies could be said to be subordinating the kids who don't get to go to the schools that they want to go to on the basis of their skin color.
And you say what to that, Sharon Brown?
Well, what it's doing is it's discriminating against some students on the basis of race and giving preferences to other students on the basis of race, and that certainly offends the principles that this country was built on. We have our Pledge of Allegiance that we teach our students at a very early age that requires that there's supposed to be justice for all, but when we are discriminating against some students and giving preferences to other students simply because of their skin colors, we are just eliminating what this country was built on, and especially what these programs are doing. I think one of your callers mentioned 30% of the parents that can afford it move their students from public schools to private schools. So what these programs are doing are burdening the very students and the parents who they are intended to benefit. And it's putting more burdens on students of low income. If we'd improve our school districts so that all the schools provide that excellent education, which we can do, then what we would be doing is bringing diversity into our schools. We would be providing them with the skills that they need to succeed in today's society.
Could I make one short comment in response to this last point about school quality? Ms. Brown has said several times that what we really ought to be focusing on is the quality of the schools and not the racial composition. And I think there's a tremendous tremendous attraction to that point of view, but there's a fallacy at the center of it, which is that school racial composition is an important determinant of school quality, and we've known this through mountains of research that tell us how difficult it is to attract good teachers and to have them stay at schools that are overwhelmingly minority in composition. Teachers, when they have choices, and they often do once they get some seniority, tend to migrate in ways that sort themselves out such that the least experienced, least credentialed teachers end up in the highest minority schools, whereas the best teachers with the most experience end up in the suburbs typically, or in the schools with the greatest number of white children. And that is a function of school racial composition, even independent of other factors like salary, like the students' performance on test scores and also working conditions.
I want to dovetail with those remarks by reading another email here. This is from Jeff in Vallejo, who says, "I find the whole program today just frustrating. The question of diversity is really not the core issue here. The fact is, quality education is what is the issue. To have black parents fighting to get into white schools or white into black misses the point. The issue is parents want the best education available. Racial segregation is diverting us from the true issue, which is why in a publicly funded school system, poor performance is tolerated. As a parent, I should expect that I can send my children to any public school and receive at least an adequate education, which I cannot. This is in part due to the smokescreen of race, which allows school officials and districts to continue to be dysfunctional and evade true accountability." And by the way, Michael, education, not diversity, should be the goal of education. I didn't say anything. Jeff, I don't know why you're directing that to me. But let me go to more calls here. And from Stockton, Tim, you're on.
Yeah, great, great program. Fantastic. God, there's so much grist for the mill here. I sometimes fear that the mill's getting worn out, but I'm starting to really hear some gems here. And I think primarily we do have to focus on accountability and the level of education in terms of quality of education. And I think that there is a direction to go. It's interesting in our society we put so much emphasis on, you know, our cultural backgrounds and our diversity and so forth, but On the other hand, it seems to be just old news. It's not a black and white issue, as the previous caller alluded to. This is a very, very diverse country, and people will mill with one another on a regular basis. Asians will hang with Asians, whites will hang with whites, blacks will hang with blacks. That is a natural thing. We want to definitely embrace freedom of choice, and we have no tolerance for racial discrimination. Children left to their own resources do not discriminate against one another. It's the biases that adults carry to the table that filters down into the school systems, into children's, and what comes out of their mouths at times. We've got to focus on quality of education and the accountability at every level of education, and we need to compensate teachers for that level of accountability. I'm telling you, teachers that get into this profession that I can see are sincere, and they're trying to do their best. There needs to be, as you say, we need to leave some of this old stuff and relook at our education, education reform, and let's get it going with the quality of education and let people choose where they want to live. You can't mandate where people live or where they go to school. That directly contradicts what this country is all about. But anyways, you guys are doing a great job, and keep it up, and I'll take your comments off.
All right, Tim, let me thank you for your comments. I don't know who wants to jump in response to Tim's comments. But
well, I'll
Sharon
jump
Brown,
in.
Yeah.
Yes, because I think he's absolutely right. What we do is we have school boards, we have school districts that handle their budgets. They are the ones that can allocate the resources. It's not race. It's the school boards that can actually decide where the resources are going to go. And if the teachers need a boost in salary so that they go to an underperforming school, then that's where the budget should be directed. They should make sure that all the schools have advanced placement courses. In California, after Proposition 209 was passed, we noticed that there's been an improvement in reading scores, math scores, and the number of students taking advanced placements. That was all a result of California that does not use race in assigning students to public schools. And I don't believe any parent is going to be pleased that their school is underfunded, but that their schools are racially balanced. That's not the purpose of our education system.
Looks like you're going to get the final word here because we are out of time, but I want to extend thanks to all of our guests this hour on the panel: Sharon L. Brown, principal attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation; Gordon Liu, who's assistant professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law and co-directs the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on race, ethnicity, and diversity there; and Alice Mundy, who joined us from Washington, a journalist with the Seattle Times. We will continue to monitor this, and we will wait with bated breath to find out what the Supreme Court's ruling will be. I want to thank not only our guests, but thank you, our listeners, because we are here because of you, and we appreciate your listenership. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And in the hour ahead, we're going to find out all about a program that the National Endowment has called Poetry Out Loud. Thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.